This podcast is for informational purposes only. We are not medical professionals and do not provide medical advice. Consult a healthcare provider for any health concerns. Opinions expressed are not a substitute for professional medical guidance.
This edition of the Optimize We podcast is brought to you by the Biohacking Index. Visit biohackingindex.com for ratings and reviews of your favorite wellness solutions and wellness providers. Hello and welcome to the Optimize We podcast, where we share biohacking truths and longevity tips without the BS. I'm your host, Lindsay O'Neill, and today I am joined by a very special person who I actually really look up to and admire. So I'm going to try not to be nervous when I'm interviewing this amazing, beautiful woman, Cynthia Thurlow. Welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this discussion.
Well, we got introduced by a dear friend of the two of us who I've already previously had on the show. And she's one of my favorite people because she's such a badass in business. She's also a badass in life. She's overcome so many different issues to get to where she is, to create products that help millions of people. And I know you're doing very much the same thing. So I'd love to just hear about how you got to where you are today.
You know, it's part of that life less traveled, the path less traveled that we speak to. So I come from a traditional allopathic background. I was first an ER nurse and then kind of gravitated as a nurse practitioner into cardiology and did that for over 20 years. And having a child with life-threatening food allergies kind of opened me up to the possibility that maybe there was something we were missing in traditional allopathic medicine. And so as he got older and the more I understood about the influence of environment and food and, dare I say, vaccines that could be impacting this generation and the propensity of food allergies, it really opened me up to the possibility that I probably didn't learn it all in my medical training. And there's a book I always like to give credit to Robin O'Brien, the book, The Unhealthy Truth, which totally changed my life, the trajectory of everything I do. And so 9 years ago, I left traditional allopathic medicine, not with a business plan, but with a desire to be able to continue to impact people, but in a different way, and really focused in on lifestyle as medicine. And so I've kind of nicely found myself in this niche, really speaking to women north of 35 and perimenopause and menopause. I've done a couple TEDx talks. I have a podcast that's kind of devoted to this. And so I very humbly now, in the second chapter of my life, am really focused in on helping women navigate middle age and beyond and do it in a way where there's transparency and advocacy and inspiration so that they can live their best lives and not, kind of fall into what I would like to think is the social media norm, which is to make everything doom and gloom, that somehow once you are, transitioning, through reverse puberty, my kids are really going through puberty or kind of probably at the tail end of it. And I'm gone through reverse puberty, helping people navigate like what's happening in our bodies. How can we advocate for ourselves? How can we live our best lives and not look at things through a glass half full, but really looking at things with a glass half full as opposed to a glass half empty, which, again, that social media norm where there's kind of a normalization of women suffering and women feeling like they're not empowered and, in fact, influenced by a lot of people that I think have good intentions, but don't actually put good information out there.
I love that you say that about social media and also like kind of reverse engineering your hormones and the changes that you go through as a young adult. I have two 14-year-old daughters, a 12-year-old daughter, and a 10-year-old daughter, and also made huge transitions in my life because of my youngest daughter. I was hit by a car when I was pregnant with her at 7 months at the height of my career. Made over $1 million in tech the year before. And that's kind of what I want to talk to you about today, because you talk about a lot of different topics on your everyday wellness podcast. And so I think everybody who's listening should go and also listen to Cynthia's podcast. You should check her out on her website. You should watch her TEDx, like 15 million plus people have also done. You mentioned before we even got on this call that you're an introvert, which is so weird for someone who's given to TEDx, who's been on TV, who hosts a podcast every week. tell me a little bit more about that dynamic and how you transitioned from being an allopathic doctor working one-on-one with patients to now being this really figurehead in our industry of holistic and functional medicine.
Well, thank you. I very humbly say that when you're doing what the universe or God has intended you to do, it makes it easier to show up. And so I grew up in a household that where there's a lot of chaos. And so I think I became an introvert and someone that's always kind of watching patterns and watching behavior. And so that's how I kind of existed throughout my childhood into young adulthood. And what I found is I always was in student government. I was always someone that was outspoken if it was about education. And so for me, a lot of being a nurse and a nurse practitioner is really educating. And so when I'm wearing that hat, if you will, that proverbial hat, then I don't feel uncomfortable. I don't think about the fact that I'm standing in front of people. I'm really just serving people. And so that to me is very different than like if you stuck me on stage and, you know, wanted me to act, I wouldn't show up in the same way. So I think the way that my mind works is I'm serving others, and therefore I kind of take my introverted self. I'm extroverted enough in that introversion that I can show up, I can be at events, I can be around people, and then I'm like that rubber band that gets stretched. So I think if I were to talk to my therapist about this, I'm sure she would probably agree with me that like part of my inner work is showing up for people in a way that serves them. And so it feeds my desire to help others, and it doesn't feel like a burden. Like I hear some colleagues, and I don't know why you would be in public speaking if you felt like it was a burden, but I hear some colleagues and the way that they describe it, you know, they don't see it that way. But for me, it's like I get energized when I step on stage, when I'm serving people in that way. So it's like a very fine delineation. If you were to say, Cynthia, I've got this play going, I have a perfect part for you, I would say, nope, can't do that. But I can show up, I can speak on stage about something when I'm in a position of authority or perceived as an expert in a particular space because I'm helping people. And so I think that's how I navigate my introversion. Like if you were to see me at a party, I'm never the center of attention. In fact, I do best in like small groups of people. My husband's a bigger introvert than I am. And so we have one introverted child and one extroverted child. And so the extrovert, you know, really challenges me to think about how he sees the world and how he get where he obtains energy from. Like I always say, like I go inward when I want to recharge, whereas he likes to be around people. Like that's the way that he gets charged up. So I think it's just honoring who we are as bio individuals. But I think I love interjecting that into conversations because people are oftentimes really, really surprised to learn that I'm an introvert.
Yeah, I mean, it makes no sense cerebrally. So, but in thinking about my own faith and how that's been challenged throughout like injury, illness, and then divorce and then pandemic and all of the things, really we show up when we're in service because it's God's will. Yes. And that's what I truly believe, and that's the law that I live by. I wake up every morning, I pray before we go to bed. We share our gratitude about all the things that we have. And a big thing that I feel very grateful for is being able to serve people by sharing amazing stories like yours. Now, you mentioned that you made this leap and this jump because of your son, who had really severe food allergies. A lot of moms out there are like, me too. My kid, there's so many allergies that are happening now. This is a new thing. Like when I was going to school in the 80s, there weren't kids walking around with EpiPens.
You had one weird kid, and I always say weird, and I say this lovingly as a parent with a child with life-threatening food allergies, you had like one kid with a peanut allergy, and that was weird. You know, that was unusual. You know, we have a constellation, an explosion of food allergies. And the sad thing is only 30% of kids will outgrow those. So my child, who is now 19, will never outgrow his peanut or tree nut allergies. And so I share this because I think a lot of people can relate. You know, once our children leave the nest, if you will. So my oldest son is a rising sophomore in college. So we dropped him off at college last August. One of the hardest things I've ever done, but he was exactly where he needed to be. He was so happy, surrounded by new friends, old friends, just a really great situation for him. And the next morning I got a phone call, the kind of phone call you don't want from your kid. And it's 6:30 in the morning, my phone rings, and I was like, well, that's weird. And it's Jack, so it's my oldest son. He's walking back from the ER. And he goes on to tell me that he couldn't get an Uber. You know, he goes to school in a rural part of our state. Couldn't get an Uber to get home from the hospital. So he mentioned I was just going to walk. I'm just watching my map, and I know how to get back to campus. And he tells me that he was in one of his friend's rooms the night before. He bit into a protein bar. He knew instantly. And this is my careful kid. This is my not devil may care, fly by the seat of his pants kid. This is my conscientious, thoughtful kid. Bit into a protein bar, realized instantly he must have ingested peanut or tree nut. He fought me about bringing his EpiPens to college. He didn't think he needed them. I remember leaving them on his desk, and he said, as soon as that food substance hit my tongue, I knew I was in trouble. And so he immediately told his friend, like, run back to my room, grab my EpiPens. He's like, I went to the bathroom to try to throw up. He's like, I started to realize my throat was closing up. This has never happened to him before. You know, he grabbed his EpiPen, he injected himself, and he told his friend, call 911. And so my son spent the first night of his college experience in an ER, essentially being told by the doctor, you are so lucky that you were close to a hospital, that you had your EpiPens, because, I mean, he spent like 10 hours in the ER. They were talking about admitting him to the ICU, and he was doing this all by himself because he wasn't home, and because he's an adult, they don't have to call the parents. And so I share this as, like, we had a happy ending, but I mean, like, incredibly sobering. Like, the thing we fear as parents with children with food allergies is that they're going to have an episode of anaphylaxis, which is this serious allergic reaction, and that they're not going to be able to be helped. And, you know, for me, it was like this, you know, every fear that you have, you know, I saw plenty of anaphylaxis reactions as an ER nurse, and many of them that don't end in they don't end in happy endings. And to know that my son was by himself, but was super clear-headed, knew what he needed to do, called for help. And one of my friends said to me, as scary as that must have been for you and your husband, isn't it nice to know that all that training that you've been doing all those years when he was blowing us off or trying to appear to be, like, he knew he was very calm, cool, and collected. Like, when all that was happening, he knew exactly what to do. Like, give myself my EpiPens, call 911, and then all of those things happen. So I think for every parent listening, and when my son was diagnosed with life-threatening food allergies, I keep reemphasizing that because I was told by the allergist to carry EpiPens and pray. Like, that was the advice when I had this one-year-old with food allergies, which didn't sit well with me for a variety of reasons, because then you become fearful to go to a restaurant or go to a family member's home or cross contamination, or you're on an airplane and someone's opening up peanuts. And so every parent with food allergies is always worried about, like, when is that going to happen? And so for us, I always said, well, we got it out of the way, like, up front. Like, it wasn't like it was 6 years after he moved out and this happened. It was that very first night of college on his own. And he would be the first person to tell you, like, I should have read the food label. I should have been careful and conscientious. And then I remember him saying, like, thank you for not listening to me when I told you I didn't need my EpiPens, because it probably saved my life.
It's amazing to me that this happened on his first night, because
yeah,
this has now set the tone. Now he's going to be extra careful for the rest of his college. And you can actually take a big, deep breath. I'm
yeah.
sure the rest of the year was not as stressful as that first
no.
day.
Nope. Nope, because I was ready to go pick him up. I was like, do you need us to come to you? Do you need me to come get you? Are you okay? And he was like, I'm fine. I'm good. He's like, you know, and I froze because he's in a mountainous part of the state. He was cold. He said it sobered me up really quickly, like in terms, like sobered me up, meaning I got clarity immediately about the fact that I just can't. I can't be one of those people that just eats something without thinking about what's in it. And so I look at it as a dual-edged sword. Like, it was a valuable lesson for him, but it was a safe, valuable lesson because it had a positive outcome. But I remember the ER physician saying to him, had you not had your EpiPens that close, you might not be alive. And I said, I'm glad he said that to you because you don't listen to me because I know nothing. But you'll listen to the ER physician who I'm sure you're probably not the first college kid that's made that mistake. You know, maybe it's one of those life's blessings. Like, and it doesn't have to be food allergies. It could be any diagnosis that your kid has. It's like our kids are our Achilles heel. You know, it's like that is like our one, like I say all the time, like I'm tough, I'm resilient, but my kids are my Achilles heel. Like that is the one thing, like I'm ferociously protective, as I know most parents are, but it's like you can only do, you hope that you have indoctrinated, educated, done all of these things to help them understand, like, what do you need to be conscientious of as a kid with food allergies? And so I think it just validated, like, he had been listening all those years, even when we thought he wasn't listening. And I would say to any parent, like, our kids are listening. They are always listening. And sometimes it takes having, like, a mini hiccup for them to realize, like, oh, wow, like, I knew exactly what to do because my parents have been telling me probably every day for my entire life what I need to do if I get into a problem. So I sit in gratitude, to be honest with you.
It's a major blessing that he had that experience because he got to have that experience. And a lot of parents with, you know, my child, where I got hit by a car, she ended up with a lot of physical and digestive issues and also life-threatening food allergies on top of it. So I spent a lot of her early childhood being kind of like a helicopter parent, which I promised myself I would never become. I would never become that crazy person who's like, oh, don't touch that. Oh, don't do that. Like, I want them to make their own mistakes. I want them, even from a young age, I think it's important. We've all been desensitized. Our children have been desensitized by the devil in our pocket. We're constantly on our phones, ignoring connection, ignoring, you know, the things around us. And so look at how many accidents happen now with people driving. Look at
it. It's crazy.
That is scary for me. I'm going to have a driver in a year and a half at 16 years old, and she can't even remember what I told her to do because she's on her phone, you know, and they're not allowed to have Snapchat or Instagram or anything like that. But all of these kids are like massively distracted by all the things that are happening. And so how do you toe the line between letting them fail and letting them make their own mistakes and learning from those mistakes and also doing your job as a parent, keeping them safe? It's a nearly impossible balance.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is definitely challenging. I'll be honest with you. There's things that I used to stress about that now I'm like, my father passed away last year, but had very strict parents, authoritative kind of parents. And so I decided I was going to parent very differently. And my mother was visiting. I'll give you an example. When I was growing up, I was expected to be out of bed, bed made, breakfast, showered by 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'm not that way with my kids. I'm like, they get good grades. They're good kids. I don't care if they sleep till noon because, you know, if it's on the weekend or it's during the summer, it's kind of like the being conscientious about picking your battles. And so I think before my kids were driving, I was probably appropriately, just like you are, like the fear of driving because it's a huge responsibility and explaining that to them. And what's interesting is number one kiddo went to a high school that's maybe 12 minutes from our house. Number two kiddo drives into the city every day because he goes to a different high school. You better believe the number two kiddo, because he's been driving more than his older brother ever did, is actually, you know, probably 2 years ahead in like driving maturity just by virtue of the fact he's in there more often. But of course, having those conversations about, you know, do we put an app on your phone that turns your cell phone off while you're driving? You know, those are the kinds of conversations. Like, I don't care where you are, I don't care who you're with, but if someone is drinking and you need a ride, they have Uber on their phone. So I'm always like, you always have it, or you call us, like any time of the day or night, I don't care where you are, who you're with, we will come get you. So I think that we try to make sure that we kind of identify things that we're most concerned about. I moved to a part of my state where teenage drinking here appeared to be much more prevalent than where we were before. Right. And so when we moved here, that was one of the first conversations. Like, if you choose to have a drop of alcohol, do not drive your car. I don't care where you are, we will come get you. Yeah. Like, no questions asked. So making sure they know that there are, and I'm like, I'm not going to have a conversation with you. We'll have a conversation the next day, but I will come get you. I will come get your friends. You know, we are those parents where we're like, it's statistically highly unlikely that our kids are not going to drink in high school. So I'd rather just, instead of setting expectations, and by no means am I condoning underage drinking, let me be very clear.
Right.
But I also think it's important to have those conversations or to talk about, like, I sent my son to college with Narcan. Now, people might be surprised to hear that. I trained in inner city Baltimore, and back then it was a fentanyl. It was a opioid crisis, so heroin. Now it is fentanyl. There are kids ingesting pills. They don't realize they're ingesting fentanyl, and they die. And so part of, again, it's my nurse practitioner brain, but also, like, I saw a lot of horrific things happen in Baltimore after living there. It's like, I could sit back and say, don't do drugs. And I do not condone drug use. I'm not, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm also a realist. Like, there is going to be a kid, and I said this to my older son, there will be someone on your floor. There will be someone you know in your fraternity. There will be someone who accidentally ingests something they do not realize what it is. And it's better to just have Narcan on hand. And these are the signs if someone's had an overdose. I can't believe how much more sophisticated kids are now than I was when I was in college 30 plus years ago. And so I'm very much a realist. Like, I'd much rather preemptively have those conversations. I was the mom, which embarrassed my kids intensely before they were sexually active, having conversations with them about, you know, if you need access to condoms or you need just access to information. Again, I'm not per se condoning premarital sex. I'm just saying, like, I am a realist. I've just seen what happens when kids don't have good access to information. And so I appreciate how I felt before my kids were driving. It is absolutely terrifying. In fact, I had a cardiologist I used to work with. And when my kids were babies, I was always worried about SIDS. I don't know why that was my greatest fear, SIDS, a SIDS death. Sudden infant death syndrome. And my colleague said, oh, you don't know fear. Wait until your kids are driving. And he's absolutely right. Like, when they're driving, there's so many variables, things you can control, things you cannot control. And so I always tell them, you know, just be careful. Don't be distracted on your phone. In fact, my younger son, his phone won't, even if I try to call him when he's in the car, it won't ring. It goes directly to voicemail. So I'm like, okay, at least he's listening. It is far more challenging than it was when you and I first started driving. There are a lot more distractions.
Well, and I actually grew up in New York City, so I never...
Oh, yes.
And now I live in the suburbs of New York, and it's a totally different ballgame, to your point about drinking. But my mom, even regardless of all of that, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in New York City, going to high school, taking 3 subways at 5 o'clock in the morning to get to
practice.
And my mom always said, and I'm a tiny human, you know, I'm not a big intimidating person. I'm a very slight, you know, 105-pound, 5'4" human being. And I was way smaller even in high school. So my mom would simply tell me, if you can't be good, be careful. Same thing. You know, I always had an extra 20 on me if I needed to take a taxi cab home back in the days when there was no Uber. I had a pocket full of quarters if I needed to pick up the phone. I did have a beeper because I wasn't a drug dealer with a beeper. I was just a kid in New York City with a beeper. And, you know, my mom's a nurse also. And she had a beeper too. So we could beep each other, which was nice. But I was always raised to have a healthy amount of fear for my surroundings and to be aware. And now it's even more difficult to instill this level of awareness in our children because they're constantly on their phones.
Yeah, they're distracted. I mean, I'm surprised how many people, like, I do a lot of business travel, and, you know, I'm in a neighborhood that's very hilly, and I see people, and people are literally walking their dog and looking at their phone. And I'm like, you know, as I tell my kids, you know, your eyes and your feet should be faced the same direction. So if you're distracted, and if you're in a city, or if you are in a crowded area and you're distracted, that's when people like to take advantage of that degree of distraction. I agree with you. And I think you probably, growing up in New York City, were probably a bit more savvy, urban savvy than the rest of us. It took me a while. When I moved to Baltimore, that was like completely eye-opening, having lived in the suburbs my entire life. And I have one kid in a rural part of the state going to college. The other one wants to be in a city. And I was saying to him, you're going to get street savvy really quickly. And he does, because he drives into the city. But kudos to your mom for, you know, arming you with all the things that could help you kind of navigate the trajectory of in an urban environment, which is totally different. I mean, I think, you know, having grown up in New Jersey, I think people in that part of the United States are just very direct. It's like you're going in one direction. There's no muss, no fuss. You know, it's very clear where you need to be, where you don't need to be, which direction you need to be heading in. But I agree. I think a lot of this generation of kids is just perpetually distracted and dopamine signaling preoccupied. You know, they get these dopamine hits from looking at their phones and, you know, getting likes on social media. And I mean, I don't have daughters, I have sons. So perhaps I might be sequestered from some of the challenges and pitfalls that girl moms deal with, because there's a whole other level of expectations, influence that my boys are kind of, they're jocks. They're not really focused on any of that stuff, but I could see how it would be incredibly impressionable for young women, you know, navigating the social media terrain.
It's also, we have teenagers, like your kids are in college, in high school and college. So in their formidable years, at my kids' age now, they were going through a pandemic where they were completely dissociated from the reality of being 12 years old and being exposed to alcohol or a sexual incident for the first time. So I feel like it was a blessing and a curse. They kind of got delayed. But now it's even more important for them going off on their own. You know, I keep thinking, I've got 4 years with my two oldest.
Yeah.
Like that's all I have.
It'll go by like this.
It goes by like that. And I feel this like pressure that I need to like teach them how to cook, make sure that they know how to like do their laundry. They know how to drive safely and interact with friends safely and boyfriends safely and like advocate for themselves in a school environment, in a social situation. There's like so much pressure. I feel like the clock is ticking. I feel like the sand is emptying. And I have like, okay, I have to have this conversation and that conversation. And we as moms take on all of that responsibility and all of that pressure. And it's not necessarily ours to hold. You know what I'm saying? So like you've completely transformed your career while also parenting your children, while also going through the same thing that all of us have gone through. I think it's really important for us to be authentic and open and vulnerable in these conversations, because it is not easy. Also, I'm in my early 40s. I'm going through perimenopause. My body is completely changing. My hormones are up one day, down the next. And I'm not the type of person to do any sort of synthetic hormone replacement therapy. So I'm doing all the things naturally. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, how do I manage all of your stuff and all of my stuff and run a business and, you know, stay on top of like the household and the dogs and all of the things and be a great partner and wife and, you know, how do you do it all? You can't.
No, it's impossible. And anyone that would tell you that you can find balance, they're lying. It's elusive. I think that the wonderful thing is that when I decided to leave clinical medicine in 2016, you know, my kids at that point were 11 and 9. So I had been the like really hands-on parent, because my husband did a lot of international business travel. And I only worked very part-time as an MP. I worked 2 or 3 days a week. I mean, it was almost like a very, very, very part-time job. My practice was really good to me. So I was the one that did all the drop-off, all the activities, all the cooking, all those things. So I feel like by the time I was kind of making this trajectory, 2016 to 2018, my business was still kind of just brewing, and I was very flexible. I didn't work as much as I do now. And so I think my kids were able to kind of watch the business grow with time. And it really, 2019 is when everything changed, so 6 years ago. But they've been able to see the fact that you know, I'm very conscientious. I'm the kind of person that I'm very present with them. And especially now that they're older, like when they want to talk to me, everything stops. They know that, you know, if they come to me and I'm working, obviously I'm doing a podcast, I'll just do one of these and check in with them. But they know that they are, you know, second only to my relationship with my husband, and we've been married for 23 years. They are my top priorities. They will always be. They will always come before everything else. And so I think that, you know, number one, as a middle-aged woman, you have to take care of yourself. And so what did that look like that was different for me at 35 versus 45? It was, I stopped doing these crazy intense workout classes. I stopped getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to the gym. I started sleeping more. I started being more conscientious about when I ate and what I ate. Started creating greater boundaries. I mean, those are the kinds of things that all of us have the ability to do. I find that for a lot of my like very type A executive type women, they don't want to change their lifestyle. They almost feed off that cortisol that they get, you know, that cortisol bump that they get. And then the other thing is saying no. Like I always say, work hard, play hard. When I'm not working, if I'm not traveling, like I had 5 business trips in the last like 6.5 weeks. So I had a lot of travel. Now I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks with my family. And we're unplugging. But I think for a lot of individuals, it's, you know, that balance piece is elusive. I think that for a lot of people, like as an example for myself, I had to get very granular about where my intentions went, where my time went, who do I hang out with? We don't do a ton socially. And it's not that we're not social people. It's just I'm super conscientious about who I spend time with. I mean, it has to be this level or greater. It has to be someone that serves the greater good. It has to be someone that there's a give and take in the relationship. If it's someone who's sucks all my energy, I'm sorry, I don't have time for that. And so one of the things that I've learned is that within my business, and my team knows this, there are things I'm obligated to do socially. And I accept that. That's part of building this business. And then there are things I don't need to do. And so I always think about it from the perspective, is this serving my greater purpose or is this serving my ego? And I think for a lot of business people, they do make a lot of decisions generated by what serves their ego and not what serves their purpose. So that's number one. I would say number two is being very conscientious about reminding yourself what your greatest purpose is in life. And that's being a wife and a mother. And I know that maybe sounds traditional, but ultimately, like, these are my people. These are the people that are most important to me in the whole world. And yes, my business and who I serve within it is very important to me. But what supersedes that is my family. And I think sometimes people forget that when they become successful, they forget about, like, foundationally, who got you to where you are?
Yeah.
It's your family and your close friends. So for me, the more successful my business has become, the more I learn to say no. If it's not a hell yes, it's a hell no. Mm. And there's nothing in between.
There's nothing in between. I was just about to say that. And honestly, keeping your circle tight and aligned with all of your core values, it's going to create a positive upward spiral, which is going to serve your ego eventually, right? So like I heard someone say the other day, stop asking God to bless the things that you're doing right now that you've chosen to do. Instead, ask God, you know, what is my purpose in this situation? Please give me the opportunity. And that's all ego. That's a shift in ego and being self-serving and potentially even serving others. But serving others can be an ego boost as well. Like I get a lot of joy and satisfaction helping people.
It's absolutely
why I started doing what I'm doing. It also came from, well, I went through hell with my daughter and my own health. And God, what was the purpose in that? You know, what was the true purpose in all of that? And yes, it was to shake me out of the active moving forward without thought. You know, when you're making a lot of money, you can ignore the problems that are going on in your life or going on with your family. Like you're not actually setting a strong foundation. You're just living at a surface level. And that's what I was doing. So it was great. It was traumatic and scary and arduous and costly, and it cost me a lot. Going through it, I became a better, now, you know, I'm getting married again for the second time. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And it's totally shifted from mm-hmm. when I got married at 25.
Right. I think
perspective is different. It's just, yes. I'm focused on setting a strong foundation with my future husband. And yes, the kids come second, which I never realized before because I was raised in a broken household as well. And so I always kind of came first. I never saw an example of a solid relationship in my time as an adolescent.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And maybe this is, you know, probably more personal than I had anticipated I would talk about. But for me, you know, growing up in a household where there was no emotional regulation with my parents, there was abuse, verbal and physical, there was alcoholism. I think part of how I turned out being such an introvert and just being an observer of behavior was by virtue of I had to read the room when I went home. I had to know what could I tolerate, what could I deal with, because I think part of probably what made me turn me into being like a very cerebral kind of intellectual person, being very kind of scholarly and academic, was because I could get lost in books. And so for me, I had zero, when I say zero, zero modeling behavior about relationships. So my parents got divorced when I was 7. Both parents got remarried the same year, which was traumatizing, as it is for most kids when their parents get remarried in the context of unhealthy people. And by that, I mean my parents. They both got remarried. Is that I never had any modeling behavior. So what do you do is you navigate teen years, young adulthood, having a very warped perception of what is normal. And so it's only through a constellation, I jokingly say, I'll be in therapy for the rest of my life. But meeting my husband at 30 was one of the greatest blessings because I had done enough work to that point saying, if I ever get married, if I ever have children, I will not recreate what I grew up in. So helping to kind of break those intergenerational trauma bonds that you can actually look at the research, the epigenetic changes that occur when, you know, it's like that trauma just gets magnified and perpetuated and you realize like your parents do the best they can. Like I'm in a position now where I just say, my parents did the best they can. I don't hold them responsible. I talk objectively. Sometimes that doesn't make my mother happy, but that's okay. My father's deceased. But looking at my kids, like when I say to you what I'm most proud of in my life, number one is being married for 23 years and a happy, healthy marriage. Number two is very well-adjusted, smart, great kids. Like, and I'm not just saying that as their parent, they're great young men. And that to me just affirms why the work is so important for all of us. And kudos to you for, you know, figuring out what you needed in your life and your second marriage. And, you know, I hope that it'll be everything you hope for it to be. But I think that for a lot of individuals, they can have success in their life and then they don't have success in their personal life. I think that makes it very challenging where people will have like a successful marriage, but they can't get their business to work. And so if you have both success in both areas of your life, I mean, that is a marrying of your purpose, like so cohesively, so beautifully. And so I think for a lot of individuals, it's like figuring out what that looks like. It doesn't have to necessarily be financial success. I'm just saying like, you know, you're the best at what you are within your occupation. You show up in a way authentically with high integrity and you're an example to others and that you have a happy, healthy home life. I mean, isn't that what we all aspire to have? I would think.
Yeah, we do. Even the people who grew up with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes take it for granted. And
absolutely.
I see a lot of couples and I see a lot of parents doing the same thing, which is the shame and blame. Mm-hmm. Because you're actively rooted in victimhood. And good for you for growing up in a chaotic household. I grew up in a very similar yeah. experience. And I have very much the same perspective. I don't think that if I hadn't come across specific people in my life that pushed me, whether in a good way, in a positive way, or in a negative way, out of my hiding place. Mm-hmm. In my safe zone of pretending to be somebody else so I could deserve love or acting in a certain way, like being overly gregarious and overworking myself to a point of success because then I can be happy, right? Mm-hmm. Like as parents, our main responsibility is to provide a safe and loving and productive environment for our children. And if you are in a toxic relationship where you are blaming your spouse and you are shaming your children, which is how we were raised, right? Mm-hmm. With a lot of blame and shame, and you have to do this in order to, you know, get a hug or a wink or a nod or a smile out of your parents. Not saying that my parents were like that, but a lot of people were raised that way. And now we're raising children who are less aware, mm-hmm. who are disconnected, not just from their friends and from their family, but also from themselves and from God. We have a huge chasm to cross as mothers and parents. And then most times, and I'm not saying all the time, and I'm not trying to put us into victimhood, but we forget about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important work that you're doing. This is a tough time to go through in perimenopause. It is not easy in any way, shape, or form.
Well, if I can provide some solace, it gets easier the closer you get to menopause. And, you know, 10 years ago, I felt lost. Like, I was the person who lost baby weight easily, got back in my normal size clothing, was exercising, felt good. And then I hit that wall because I was doing all the wrong things. You know, I had a very, you know, cardiology, ER medicine are just very demanding areas in medicine to work in. So high acuity, very sick patients. The NPs in my practice functioned very autonomously, which means sometimes I didn't have a doc in the hospital and I'd have an emergency and I had to manage it. Sometimes big, scary emergencies that you don't want to deal with that you do deal with because you're a healthcare provider on top of my husband traveling. My kids were young. And so, you know, the word pause is so important. We forget the pause, you know, perimenopause. We are designed to start changing how we live our lives. The people that navigate that time the best are the ones that change what they are doing. So for me, I undid everything. Like, I unwound everything I knew. And that was hard. But the closer I got to menopause and I had figured out, okay, for me personally, there are things I had to eliminate from my diet, although I ate very healthy. And I had to change how vigorously I exercised. And I had to change my stress management. And I had to, you know, have those boundaries up and be conscientious. Like, one of my therapists said to me at the time, she was like, you realize you and your mother have a codependent relationship. And I was like, no, I'm not codependent. And it was the first time someone had said that to me. And I was like, oh my God, we are. It's this enmeshment. My mom's a narcissist. And the realization, I mean, completely blew my mind. But it also gave me the knowledge to realize, like, I needed stronger boundaries. I needed to start pushing back, even as an adult. And I am not I grew up in New Jersey. I am not a pushover in any capacity, but you have habits of relationships and, you know, further defining, it's like a stone that has to continue to be finely honed over time. And so I tell a lot of women that, yes, perimenopause is fraught with a lot of, like, what in the heck is my body doing right now? Mm. You know, and being about your height, I'm like shy of 5'4", 5 or 10 pounds on me at that stage made a big difference in how I felt about myself, how I looked. You just don't have as much body to stretch it out over. And I remember just being completely befuddled. So I jokingly say, in 2019, when I got sick, I spent 13 days in the hospital. And then 27 days later, I did that talk to show my boys I was okay. And my brain hadn't really caught up with my body. So I can't even watch that talk, to be honest with you, because it's too painful. Too painful. And, you know, that was the end of having menstrual cycles. That was, you know, I was, by the end of that year, I was fully in menopause because I'd lost so much weight. And so I remind people all the time that, you know, incredible things can happen in middle age. It is, you are not washed up. It is not the end. In fact, I would say at 53, I'm more confident, happier, more settled into, like, who I am as an individual, more calm, you know, all the things that we aspire to be than I ever was 10, 15 years ago. So I think for a lot of women, it's an awakening. As we lose estrogen, we lose our people-pleasing tendencies. You'll find that you can't not. Like, my kids, they'll say, don't do it. We're in a store. Nope, don't do it. She's going to do it. She's going to tell them something. She's going to give someone feedback. No, don't do it, Mom. And I just can't help myself. And it's because of this changes in estrogen. We don't feel like we have to be as accommodating. We don't feel like we have to people please. We don't feel like we have an obligation to make everything okay for everybody all the time. And that to me is incredibly freeing. And for any woman younger than me that's listening, that's in the throes of perimenopause, that's trying to make sense of what's going on with their bodies, it gets better. I promise you it gets better.
I love the idea of pausing because it does get better. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the old adage is time heals all wounds. It's not necessarily a wound, but it can feel like that. You know, when you wake up after sweating all night and you feel like your body is completely just giving out. And a lot of women are trying to do all of the things, right? They're following the guidebook of what do you do during menopause. And it's really important to get the word out about creatine. You know, I didn't know this until I became friends with JJ Virgin. And she's like, you know, nobody, everybody loves her arms, but nobody wants to do the work that she does to keep her body. She's a decade older than you, I believe. So you're a decade older than me. She's in her early 60s.
Let me just say, because JJ and I are very good friends, and I just saw her this past weekend. We both spoke at the same event. JJ is 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
And JJ has that kind of, you know, degree of muscle mass and low body fat that is incredible. And I always say to her, you know, everyone looks at your arms, you're like, I would like to have that. Now, some of us physiologically, even if we're fairly lean, we're never going to be that defined. But I always tell her she's like a glamazon.
She is.
You know, like a glamorous Amazon. Like she's this very tall, very fit, very muscular, beautiful woman.
She's an introvert also.
Yes, that's why we get along really well.
Yeah. I just saw her last week also at a different conference. She's been bouncing around. I actually saw her twice in a week in New York, once in New York and once in Austin.
Yeah. So I was in Palm Beach, which is where she bounced from Austin to Palm Beach, which is where I saw her.
So funny. And people look at like a woman like you who's 53. They look at a woman like her who's 62, 63. And they say, well, I can never look like that. I can never accomplish that. Because of how I feel in this moment. And so going back to your biohack tip of the day, probably where you hang your hat in a lot of your conversations, is just take a pause. Love your body. Give it positive affirmations. I actually had a really funny experience yesterday. I came home. I went out to dinner with a girlfriend of mine that I haven't seen in a couple of years. And actually, her husband just passed away. And it was very sudden and it wasn't expected. And, you know, she's still reeling from it, but she just turned 50 last year. And this kind of like kicked her into emotional trauma. Physical trauma can actually kick you into perimenopause or menopause a lot.
Yes, it can. Yes, it can.
And so I was telling her I had just come from like driving my kids from place to place and like making dinner real quick and then just kind of like throwing everything on the table, waiting for my fiance to come home. And I ran into the city, drove into the city. And as I was driving into the city, my youngest daughter calls me and she's like, Mom, can I go outside? Because typically if I leave them home alone, I'm like, don't open the door. Everything's like locked. The cameras are on, you know, and I've got 14-year-olds in the house, so they're fine being home alone. She's like, can I go out to the garden? I forgot to talk to the onions.
Oh.
And I'm like, no, you can't go outside until, you know, my fiance gets home. And I said, but, you know, don't forget to talk to them. So we have planted this 50-foot organic garden for the last 4 years since I moved into this house. And every year I've had trouble growing anything in the ground, carrots, onions, beets, anything that grows inside the ground, anything that grows above the ground for some reason flourishes. I don't know why. So this year we planted 100 onions.
Oh, wow.
It's impossible to find organic onions anywhere in New York. And the rule of thumb, at least in my house, anything that grows in the ground has to be organic. Potatoes, onions, carrots, like there's no room for anything non-organic that grows in the soil. So she goes outside and she's like, all right, she's level 2 Reiki certified, by the way, at 10 years old.
Amazing.
So she's doing like Reiki and prayer and like just, you know, talking to the onions. They are incredible. Everything else now that's growing above the ground is dying and like has bugs and getting eaten by rabbits. And so I told her, I'm like, maybe when you go outside, you can actually talk to
Yeah, eat vegetables.
Other vegetables, because they're all getting demolished. And I told this to my friend when we sat down at dinner, because she's going on and on about like, oh, you know, and this is happening to my body, and this is happening to my body, and you know, this is happening in my life. And it's just like she's piling onto herself. And I'm an empath, so I'm like,
I totally get that.
Shoulders as earrings, like my heart starts racing. And I'm like, just why don't you just shift the way you're talking to yourself? Like, just take a pause. Take a pause.
So important.
Change the conversation that you're having with your body, because all of our cells are listening to the words that we're telling them. Just like the onions are listening to Bryn, your cells are listening to the words that you're saying to yourself. So I'm not telling you to get like all woo-woo and crazy and that kind of thing, but just be more mindful of how you're talking to yourself. And she's like, that's really interesting. She goes, now how do I sleep? Because I don't sleep anymore. She's like, I have to listen to podcasts. Like, I listen to like murder mystery podcasts in order to fall asleep. And I said, well, that's because you don't actually want to sleep. You don't want to be alone with your thoughts.
Yeah.
But my other friend said, well, why don't you just listen to like binaural beats? And she's like, no, I definitely can't do that. And I said, no, I don't think you should do that either. But maybe listen to guided meditation. You know, listen to like Dr. Patrick Porter from Brain Tap, or listen to Joe Dispenza, you know, mindful meditation for falling asleep. So that you can get into the parasympathetic, because your body, since the death of your husband, has just been
fight or flight.
And that's why your hormones are going crazy. But it's just this negative.
You probably need some progesterone too. Like, let's be like, you know, I think bioidentical hormones, I can tell when a patient comes to me who's on bioidentical hormones, because their sleep, their muscle mass, their insulin sensitivity is all better. And I think for a lot of women, and especially someone who has gone through such a traumatic experience and understandably is probably still processing everything that's occurred, we become less stress resilient as we are navigating that perimenopausal transition. So we have to do more than we ever did before. Like I always say that, you know, my dad died, the first anniversary of his death was Monday, when my functional integrative medicine doc was checking my cortisol levels in the fall. He kept saying, you lost your dad, your stepmother, your stepfather, your husband got sick, had a major surgery, and my husband's had a kind of a constellation of, he's better now, I'll just put it that way. But many, many months of really, really high stress.
Almost died this first day in college.
Hell yeah. Yep. And then, you know, writing a book. And so there was a lot. And he said, if I didn't know what you had shared with me already, I would not have believed this was the same person. So when I tell patients, you have to practice stress management daily. Obviously, if someone's in an acute stress, you tragically lose someone very quickly, it's probably hard to think about doing anything, maybe other than like legs up the wall. But that might be all they can do. Then they might not be able to handle technology, or Joe Dispenza is like one of my favorite people to refer people to, but sometimes people's just brains aren't in the right space to be able to process or absorb anything. I think for everyone listening, we have to have a stress management practice. And I know I got really, really granular over the past year about what are the six things that have to happen before I show up for work? What are the things I need to do so that I can show up for my family? And it's different for each one of us, but I think that your friend who's going through so much, I love that she's like, okay, I need to listen to something to fall asleep. But maybe something as simple as like legs up the wall before she goes to bed might be enough to tell her body, okay, we're gearing down, you know, we're going to get out of the sympathetic. The other thing is, you know, targeted supplementation. So I think about inositol, I think about adaptogenic herbs, I think about L-theanine, you know, even having decaffeinated green tea, L-theanine's in there, and that's an amino acid that can be very, very helpful for kind of calming that autonomic nervous system. For a lot of people, they might not be ready to do higher level things, but just simple things they can integrate into their schedule or their lives that don't feel like a burden, because that's probably where she is. It's like another have to is probably more than what she can, process. So like easy things, like doesn't require any, put your legs up the wall and listen to your podcast or music or, you know, Joe Dispenza, who's amazing. Yeah.
And honestly, that's, so the name of the first business that I founded in the health industry is called Small Hinges. And that was because small hinges swing the big door of positive change. Most people get overwhelmed, especially going from, you know, this, you went from allopathic medicine to functional medicine. You were still a medical practitioner and you still didn't know, you know, anything about functional medicine, right? You're like, I didn't learn any of this stuff in my traditional college and medical education. And that's the same case for lay people too, like a regular school teacher or a businessman or someone in finance. They don't know like even the beginning parts of this. So last night at dinner, I started to, you know, tell her about like all the cool stuff that I saw at the biohacking conference last week in Austin. I'm like, this red light panel and this vibroacoustic chair and this meditation thing and this cool, you know, EEG machine that you can put on your head that gives you all of these data points. And she's like, I can like see her like retreating from me, like falling backwards. And I'm like, but the biggest thing that I really learned is that we just need to sleep. And that's when she asked the question about sleep. Like the biggest biohack is just sleep. There were so many companies that were dedicated, whether it was a supplement company or a meditation or a
mind foundation or
whatever it was. And so if you're not sleeping, your body is constantly stressed. Cortisol levels are high. And so no matter what supplement you take, no matter what technology you use, it doesn't actually matter.
Yeah. I tell everyone it is foundational to our health. If you can't sleep through the night, don't add in fasting. Don't suddenly start doing super intense exercise. Fix your sleep. And that's not sexy. Like people don't think sleep is sexy. But when I look at my data metrics in the morning and I'm like, I got almost 2 hours of deep sleep as a 53-year-old, I'm like, you know, what I'm doing works. Yes. But I think for a lot of people, it's like they think it's all the other things. And I oftentimes will say to women, if you could focus just on one thing, it would absolutely be sleep. And then, you know, the weight loss resistance starts to improve and then their mood improves and their food choices improve. And then they have more energy to want to exercise and, you know, they show up differently in their personal and professional lives. And so I think that just like babies, like we go back to like, what do babies need to do? They need to poop, they need to eat, and they need to sleep. And so it goes back to that same thing. If your baby's not doing one of those three things, it's a problem. So, you know, we as adults, it's very simple. Like we have to think about it from a very kind of evolutionary perspective. It's not until you've mastered the basics that you move on to more advanced strategies. And certainly I can imagine at Dave's event, you probably saw a lot of really cool technology.
And it's overwhelming for even me, who's in the industry.
Right.
I've been exposed to it for 3 years now, and I've had amazing conversations with these amazing founders, but I still get lost in the sauce. You know, I went to FIT. I'm a fashion major. I was an art major. You know, I'm not a technologist. By trade, I am a technologist, but I kind of got thrown into that after 9/11 happened. I just found myself in this cool, new, booming industry, and now I'm doing the same thing in my 40s in this cool, new, booming industry, and I feel this responsibility to take the impalatable and make it palatable for the masses. And that's why I have beautiful people like you who are telling millions of people how to just take that first step, push that first domino over, and that hits all of the other dominoes. And I love that you said babies need to eat, poop, and sleep, because that's the second domino is pooping or like detoxification. Mm-hmm. So many times I work with women who are like, oh, I can't lose weight. I'm like, well, are you sleeping? No. Are you pooping? No. How often do you poop? I poop once a day or once every other day. I'm like, that's
twice
not
a week.
Right.
Yeah, twice a week.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so how are you expected to lose any weight or to detoxify your body? Yes, you're putting in good things, but you're not getting rid of all the the shit.
And they recirculate their estrogen. And, you know, we are already estrogen dominant and relative estrogen dominance. And perimenopause, it just magnifies all those symptoms. So you're right. And again, it goes back to foundationally, what do all being, even my dogs, like they have to eat, sleep, and poop. And that's just how it works. And so I think a lot of us just get, I don't know, I think whatever we experience, we think is normal. So when a woman says to me, I have one bowel movement or two a week, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. We got to work on that too. That's huge. That's a huge problem. but they don't necessarily perceive it that way.
So the three P's and one S in my practice now, after talking to you, are going to be pause, poop, pray, because I always do that anyway. And I feel like praying helps me get recentered. Even if you're just praying to the universe or praying to whatever God you believe in or praying to yourself, praying to a deceased loved one, whatever it is, pause, pray, and poop, and then sleep. So PPPS is my new biohack for the day.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for getting me there. And for getting everybody else there. So you've been on TV, you've done a TEDx that has over 15 million views. You have an amazing podcast that thousands, if not millions of people are listening to. You do a lot of work in a program, right? You have a midlife pause program. And then you have amazing supplements too. So tell us a little bit about what you've got going on, how people can follow you and engage with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. I would say, number one, I have one book that's currently published on women and fasting, and that was what was based off that viral TEDx. Second book is coming out in early 2026, really focused in on the gut microbiome and women in middle age. And when I tell you, that may not sound super sexy, but here's the hint, it impacts everything, bone health, immune function, when we go into menopause, et cetera. That'll be out in 2026. I do have a particular signature program called the Midlife Pause, which is a 12-week signature program that I teach within, as well as my coaches. And I have a lot of advanced practice nurses on my team. And then I also have a supplement line called the Midlife Pause, which was supposed to be the working title of the book, but that got axed by my editor, but that's okay. Really focused in on supplements that are science-driven. So creatine monohydrate, one of the most important foundational supplements for women, not only for preservation of muscle mass and strength, but also bone and brain and other benefits, including jet lag. Also includes vitamin D. We've got a adaptogenic mushroom blend. We have a prebiotic fiber blend. All of these are kind of the basic foundational supplements for women. We've got two new products coming out next month, which is really exciting. Yeah, my podcast is my favorite thing I do within my business. I do a lot of public speaking. I will be speaking, oh my goodness, two big international talks in the fall, one in London, so Health Optimization Summit. And then there is a brewing Middle East event that's coming that I can't share publicly yet because all the things, pieces are falling in, but it's going to be unbelievable with a lot of the biggest voices in the health and wellness space, not just here in the United States, but other places in the world as well. And then a bunch of other places in between. So I might cross paths with some of you. If you do, make sure you let me know and don't be afraid to approach me. Although I am an introvert, I love connecting with real people in real life. So www.cynthiathurlow.com. There's a link if you want to check out the supplements. You can see my podcast there as well as programs. We are on most social media platforms, although admittedly, I try to get my team to run TikTok because I'm like, I can't manage one more social media platform. We're on YouTube and that's growing. We have a free Facebook group called the Midlife Pause / my name on Facebook. I do actually answer questions in there every week along with some team members. More active on Instagram. We are on Twitter, be forewarned. I can be a little snarky, although lately I've been not as snarky on Twitter, but trying to navigate the landscape of social media without being political is a constant battle. So I always say, like, my political beliefs are mine and I don't interject my politics in my social media or within my business. I always say, irrespective of your political affiliation, perimenopause and menopausal women need great support, which is why I don't think my politics matter. I'm like, I want to serve everyone. And that's the lens with which I try to communicate. But yeah, see me on my podcast. That's my favorite thing I do within my business by far.
Politics should not matter.
Correct.
It's all about the passion, the purpose, and your divine intervention with millions of women who desperately need your help, including myself. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share every ounce of goodness that you've shared, from parenting to perimenopause and everything in between. I appreciate you, Cynthia. It has been such a blessing to meet you. And I hope everybody listens to your podcast, listens to this podcast, and shares the wealth of knowledge that we discussed today and beyond.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.